Yeah, I understand life's hard, and no one gets out of this without scars and pain. The Son of God didn't, and we won't. But it's not the full story. It's not the end of the story. What we want to keep in mind is what a indescribable gift it is that we have been invited to be.
Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. Make sure you're subscribed on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast, and follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram. Now, let's get to work. Well, Pastor Brian Zahn, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast. It's great to meet you.
Curry, thank you for inviting me.
Certainly. Let's just do a quick, maybe just kind of intro to everybody. Do you mind just giving your quick bio, who you are, what you do, that sort of thing?
Yeah, my name is Brian Zond. I am lead pastor at Word of Life Church for the past 44 years. I'm a product of the Jesus movement, and by the time I was 17, I was leading a coffee house ministry called the Catacombs, that by the time I was 22, it had become Word of Life Church, and I've just stayed with this congregation. These days, though, a lot of my time is spent writing. I've just about my 12th book is about to come out. 12th book in, I think, 16 years, something like that. So I've stayed pretty busy writing, and that's a little bit of something. I'm in St. Joseph, Missouri, just north of Kansas City, so that's where I am.
I love it. I love it. It's a great jumping off point. And you mentioned your book. The reason I had you on is your forthcoming book, Unseen Existences. And I'm fascinated by this book, and I'm excited to get into it. And what I was even saying before is that so much of your personal story goes into this book. Like, the why behind this book goes into kind of these experiences that you've had, even vocationally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'd love to kind of maybe let's start with the book, and then maybe we can walk through these kind of phases as we talk about the book and it all intertwines. So why write Unseen Existences? What are you trying to sort of capture in this book?
I'm trying to recover heaven, because it seems like serious conversation, serious theological conversation regarding heaven has gone missing. And then in its wake, what you have is you have various forms of unhealthy conversation about heaven. There's the kind of the escapist, you know, I don't really have any concern for this world. I just want to fly away and be done with it all. There's the sensationalist heaven, you know, my 30 minutes in heaven and I walked upon the streets of gold, that sort of thing. And then there's the sentimentalist heaven. These are the memes you see on social media of your departed rock stars jamming in heaven on clouds of glory. And so I wanted to recover some more substantive conversation about what the Bible calls the heavens, or the spiritual realm, or the other world. And then it's tied together with understanding that our life is a pilgrimage of the soul toward our true home of union with God in the heavens. So there's sort of dual themes that are complementary. The reality of the unseen existences that most often Scripture would call heaven or the heavens, and then our life as a pilgrimage of the soul toward an end that lies within that realm. That's more or less what I'm up to.
Yeah, no, I liked it. I think I started the book and I was like, is this really something that's missing? And as you sort of unpacked it, I was like, okay, all right, I see where you're going here. And I think some of the reason I really resonated with it is because I kind of have taken a similar journey and might be at step two, where you like are in step three, right? So I'm a pastor as well, bivocational my entire career, and always felt like this world didn't really matter. I wasn't a dispensationalist, but dispensationalist theology does this, right? Where it's all going to burn.
Well, that's okay. I'll be a bit more forthcoming.
Okay. Yeah.
A lot of us grew up with dispensational eschatology because we didn't have any other choice.
Right. Right.
It was foisted upon us and we didn't know any better.
Right.
I mean, I'm speaking for myself, but I know I'm also speaking for a lot of people. And then, you know, it could have been anyone, but I'll say it this way. Then N.T. Wright comes along. God bless Tom Wright, and rescues us from our ridiculous eschatology. That's all great. That's good. That's necessary.
Yeah.
But the pendulum, as it always does, can swing too far.
Yeah.
And so we necessarily recovered a, well, I remember, you know, N.T. Wright would have this quip when one of his books came out. I think it was Surprised by Hope. He would say, heaven's great, but it's not the end of the world. and I understand what he's saying. I resonate. I understand what he's saying. I just also know that in recovering a earthy faith that has social and political ramifications, which is necessary, I endorse that. I've written books along that line. I also know that can go too far. And where we try to justify the value of our faith solely in terms of this life alone. And I think that's actually an impossible project. I don't think we can actually do that. Certainly not and be true to the New Testament. So maybe I'm trying to strike a better balance, at least as I perceive it.
No, and I appreciate that. I think something that has happened as well, as long with this earthy Christianity, as you call it, I like that term, has come a culture of politics that has kind of overwhelmed Christianity in a lot of ways. In that, like, a lot of these people were outside of, you know, beforehand when it was all going to burn, you were outside of politics. You didn't talk about politics. And now we Christian faith has been sort of almost co-opted by politics, and faith becomes earthier because our faith has like direct implications for now, which of course it does. But that means for a lot of people, it's a political implication rather than a heavenly one. Maybe is that
one of the lines that I use in the book that I like? I think it's a good one. Christianity without transcendence degenerates into politics. And again, every time I say something like this, I feel like I need to build all of my fences. I understand that the gospel has enormous political implications. I get all of that. And I'm fine with that. And I think people that are familiar with me even a little know that I've not shied away from speaking into that realm. I mean, I've written books that are largely on political theology, Postcards from Babylon being maybe the most pronounced book on that subject that I've penned. But again, you can go too far. And part of my critique of both the Christian right and Christian left is that Christian is reduced to adjective duty in service to the all-important political noun of right and left. And right and left is really what matters.
Yeah.
Christian is an accoutrement. You know, Jesus is trotted out as a mascot. Yeah. I am Jesus Christ, and I endorse this message, because our primary commitment is either to right or left politics, and then Christian is an afterthought. And that I think is a dreadful mistake. So
I would totally agree. I think this is a little one of my soapboxes a little bit, so I'll just step on it for half a second. But that if we were talking about politics, that would be one thing, and that would be okay. Politics is important. It's kind of how we're ordered. It's partisanship that we can't stop talking about. You know?
The gospel has much to say about how we would think about the flourishing of the polis,
the
common good of the polis. But what happens almost always, it seems to me, is that once Christians deliberately, as self-consciously, as an entity, as the church, step into that realm, they're almost immediately conscripted into partisanship.
100%.
And when you become a partisan actor within the political fray, what happens almost immediately is two things. One, you are viewed as simply an enemy to your opponents and as a tool to your own, you know, your adherents. And I don't want to be viewed as an enemy or a tool. I want to enact some sort of prophetic presence that really is true to the kingdom of the heavens that Jesus Christ proclaimed.
Yeah. That's good. I appreciate that, man. We hit it hard right out the gates, didn't we?
I know.
I love it. I love it. It's going to be fun.
We're not messing around, are we?
Yeah, we're not messing around. We don't have time, you know. Okay. So I would love to just pick your brain a little bit on your years of ministry and of being a Christian. Mm-hmm. I think you said you just, it's been 50 years plus of being a Christian since your conversion.
I mean, it's 50. What year is it?
26.
It's over 51 now.
51. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I had a similar experience in high school.
I'm 67. Yeah. So people are trying to figure out how old is this guy anyway? I'm 67. Thank you very much.
I love that. Yeah. I was 18 when I had a similar experience similar to what you had. And mine was
sudden, dramatic, and the talk of the high school. Everybody called me Fry. That was my nickname. And they were like, Fry, I can't believe what's happened to you. And I go, I know, right? I can't believe it either, but it has.
Yeah, very similar here. I was a freshman, and my wife and I went to the same high school. And when she started dating me, everybody was appalled that she would date somebody of my ilk, you know, my type. But both very quickly into ministry. I was doing youth ministry like 6 months after I, you know, found Jesus. Right. And,
I preached my first sermon probably within that time frame, which is absurd, ridiculous, not recommended, but it's part of the story.
Yeah. This is not the path. This is not prescriptive. Yeah. Right. So I'd love to hear about just kind of that growing up, because I know you got very into like a very charismatic church off the top. Can you just talk a little bit about those early years of ministry?
I'm happy to tell the story. So you do have to know something about the Jesus movement of the, you know, early 70s, which was sort of it was hippies finding a better Messiah than the Beatles. And I'm too young to have been a real hippie from the 60s, but a lot of young people in the early 70s, there was just this, it was this phenomenal move where all of a sudden young people are turning to Jesus. You know, it's a little bit inexplicable, but it was real. It was, I look back on it fondly. There's nostalgia involved in that, no doubt, but I do think it was aptly named, because even though we had bad attitudes towards tradition that was unhealthy and our eschatology was a train wreck, as I already mentioned, we did have a certain passion for Jesus that I still want to maintain. I just want to be a 67-year-old Jesus freak. That's all I want to do. So that's where I came to faith. And the center of the Jesus movement was not established local churches. It was generally music venues, because that was at the core of the Jesus movement was music. And so there was a thing in our city called the Catacombs. It met in the basement of this dive bar on 3rd Street, the American Tavern, and then down below it. So it was... We called it the Catacombs because, yes, it was subterranean, but also we have this affinity. Of course, a lot of this is youthful naivete, maybe almost hubris, but we had a sense of camaraderie with those early Christians because we're radical. Yeah. And so, you know, the Catacombs. And the Jesus movement just led you into the charismatic movement. I mean, if you're on that bus, that's where it's going to take you. And so... which I describe as good until it wasn't. I mean, the idea that the Holy Spirit is active and that we can experience God and that certain spiritual experiences should be viewed as normative, all of that was great. And it was great until it wasn't. You know, later on, as we moved into the 80s, you know, it became celebrity-driven, it became political, it became about money. You know, prosperity gospel got in there, and all of that took a terrible toll. And our church started very small, and it stayed small for 7 years, under 100, probably most of that time, way under 100. Like, I mean, under 50. You just say under 100, but it's actually under 50. And then... with the 90s, it just exploded, and some of that's inexplicable. I mean, maybe I have some ideas why that happened, but really, I don't know. And you're a pastor. You can understand what this might mean. Imagine be in a church under 100, and then within 7 years, you have built a 2,000-seat sanctuary and moved into it in the space of 7 years. I still look back and go, did that happen? Yeah, that did happen. And it was exhilarating. It was fun. It was exciting to have that kind of exponential growth where like every Sunday is like the biggest Sunday you've ever had, and it just kept on going. And now we're covering a lot of territory. So now I'm entering my 40s.
Yeah.
And by all of the metrics that Americans like to measure success in ministry, we had it made. You know, everything's great. Everything's great, except I was increasingly dissatisfied. I began to think, this feels too thin. This feels too accommodating, too consumerist, too American. I knew that. And I didn't know what to do about it because I was embarrassingly ignorant of the good stuff. You know, if you don't know, you don't know. And you have to find a thread somewhere. And so I didn't know what to do because I just knew my kind of charismatic word of faith world. That's what I knew. But I had an instinct. I thought, okay, I'm just going to back up in the history of the church as far as I can and start from there. And so I started reading by instinct. No one told me to do this. I just thought it might be good to read these earliest Christians. We call them the church fathers. And I just started, you know, I started like with Polycarp at the very first, and just started working my way through them. And that begins to change you. But finally, I did have a breakthrough. I'll tell you a story. So I was reading, I was doing two things. I was reading church fathers, patristics, and I was reading philosophy, which I'd had a penchant for early on. But you may not know this. The Word of Faith movement isn't big on philosophy.
Yeah. I did know that actually, but yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. They hardly ever read any Kierkegaard. But anyway, but I just thought, well, no, I do love this. So I started doing that. But I was frustrated. This is a mystical experience. We're talking about mystical experiences. So I just knew that I needed something more contemporary. I mean, reading the Church Fathers was good, but I needed something now. And I didn't know what it was. I mean, which is, it sounds like I was just stupid. But if you, again, if you don't know, you don't know. And I prayed one day. I said, God, show me what to read. I was here in my house. I said, God, show me what to read. It was like out of frustration. And 2 minutes go by. My wife walks. She has no idea what I've just prayed. She walks in the room. She walks up to me. She hands me a book. And she says, here. I think you should read this. Now it gets stranger. It gets stranger. Perry had not read this book. She found it in our house. I didn't buy it. She didn't buy it. To this day, we don't know how it got in our house. But she found it in our house and brought it to me. And I started reading it the next day. I was on a flight somewhere. You know, I'm sitting down on the airplane and I open up this book. And man, I was like 3 pages in. I thought, whoa. This is what I'm looking for. And the book, everybody wants to know what the book is. The book was The Divine Conspiracy by Dallas Willard.
Way to build tension. That was great. Done. Yeah.
And what that did, the book itself is great. The book itself is phenomenal. But more than just that single book, is it put me on track to find the good stuff. And what I did was I binge read. You know, fairly early on, I discovered N.T. Wright, and then it was Walter Brueggemann, then it was Stanley Hauerwas, others. And I would like read everything they'd written. Yeah, you know, I mean, really. And I was reading hours every night and loving it. It never seemed like, I mean, I didn't have any formal training, had no seminary. I'm just a Jesus freak kid that accidentally ended up leading a ministry that sort of more or less accidentally turned into a church. But at midlife, I found the good stuff. It changed me. And changing me is changing my preaching. And so about 22 years ago, I remember, you know, okay, everything's really changing now. And I remember preaching, this is 22 years ago. and telling my church that I am packing my bags from charismatic Christianity and moving on. By packing my bags, I'm going to take some good stuff with me. But I mean, as far as being just identified with this movement, I'm moving on from that. Now, I did it with enough, you know, rhetorical skill that they applauded until I actually did it. And then we went through a very difficult season where it was, you know, to quote Dickens, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the best of times because I was I never had a crisis of faith regarding the Christ, but I was having a crisis of faith regarding the Christianity I knew. I just felt like Jesus deserved a better Christianity than I knew, and now I was finding it, and that was the best of times. But as I began to change, grow, mature, embrace a more substantive historic faith, and then begin to disassociate with any kind of religious right, and began to critique America not as a kind of biblical Israel, but a kind of biblical Babylon. Well, you know, we lost over 1,000 people, and this was very painful. So I can tell you the stories of exponential growth and exponential, whatever the opposite is, shrinkage, exponential. Yeah. So I've done both, and. And that was a long time ago. It took us 10 years to get through that, to really just move the church to where we are today. It took 10 years. It's the hardest thing I've ever done in ministry. And it really took a toll on me. But I have no regrets now. But doing it was not easy. It was very difficult. And so people that are hearing, watching this podcast, don't feel sorry for me. I'm as happy as I can be. We're in a great place. Everything's good. But from 2004 to 2014, it was not good. It was very painful. It was very
difficult. Have to walk through those valleys, though. I mean,
well,
that's just...
Yeah. I mean, people were leaving our church by the hundreds or whatever. Yeah. These were people, you know, that we knew, loved. I mean, you're talking about people that perhaps I had led to the Lord, baptized, performed their wedding, baptized their kids, got their kids married, and now they're leaving saying I'm backslidden, when I felt like that's the last thing that's happening. I've never been more passionate for Jesus Christ and his kingdom than I am today. But, you know, such is the price you're going to pay sometimes.
Yeah.
And I do touch. I don't dwell on this, but yes, this does show up in various forms in the book.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. What I found kind of fascinating is, you know, if anybody you would think had this heavenly sort of mindset, it would be charismatics who believe in the power of the Holy Spirit, right? And are open to sort of, you know, spiritual things. And I guess those are, you know, spiritual things maybe that happen on earth. But you talk about something that I've heard very few other people kind of mention. And you talk about the two natures of Christ, and that many Christians don't actually believe in the full humanity of Christ. Whereas, you know,
right.
Yeah, I've never. Can we just kind of maybe nerd out about that?
Yeah. Let's nerd out.
Okay, sounds good.
If Christians come from a conservative background, some form of evangelicalism, charismatic. Although I just want to say this, there was never a time in my life when I self-identified as an evangelical, because I always thought, well, those are Baptists. We're not Baptists. But anyway,
it is very complicated. Yes.
Yeah. If those people have no problem with the full deity of Christ. If we say Jesus Christ is true God from true God, they say, yeah, Jesus is God. But I think most of them are unknowingly tacit docetists. This is a early church heresy coming from the word to seem, docetism, seemism, meaning that Jesus seemed to be human, but he wasn't really human. It was more like Jesus is, oh, you know, Halloween's coming up. I'm gonna go as a human. I'm going to dress up as a human. I'm going to play human. And so Jesus is, you know, flying around being God all over the place, but we can't seem to arrive at the fact that he is truly human.
Yeah.
Fully like you and me. He has a mother. He has a birth. The one who walked upon the water also sat weary at the well of Sychar, going, I'm just worn out and I'm hot and I'm thirsty. Fully human.
Fully, yeah.
And that leads to a rich, I don't know, a rich source of meditation and contemplation. That was, I talk about in the book, but that was one of the breakthroughs in my life was, and that happened in 2002, the story I tell from Rocky Mountain National Park and this mystical experience with wonder that led me to begin to meditate on the incarnation. That happened really before I made my full break with that
world. Yeah.
That was about 2 years before, but that was helping ramp some things up for me. And
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it keeps us from like really stepping into who Jesus actually is though. Like, because we see Jesus as sort of a Superman that can just kind of do whatever, right? Nothing ever kind of harms him. There's no real struggle in that Jesus, the docetist Jesus, you know?
I can't produce the quote off the top of my head, but I quote, who does I quote on this? Is it Lofink, Gerhard Lofink? It's a German, or is it Hans Urs von Balthasar, who I quote in the book saying that all of the kitsch in Christian art and theology comes from a failure to take seriously the humanity of Christ, which I think is just a great line there. It's actually a longer quote, but I know that line's in that.
Yeah.
That's one of the theologians I've found. Hans Urs von Balthasar. That guy rocks, man.
I love it.
Besides the fact that he has like the most awesome name ever.
It is legit. Although Wolfgang. Wolfgang Pannenberg might be an all-time favorite of mine, you know? But I'm with you. That's good. Okay, so let's talk about heaven then. I mean, one thing you don't do in the book is sort of describe heaven per se. You know what I mean? You're not like unpacking like the biblical, what do we know about heaven from the biblical accounts? You're unpacking how
in other words,
how
I don't use the book of Revelation to do that because basically. I don't think that's what the book of Revelation is about at all.
Yes, exactly.
The book of Revelation is this wild piling on of one metaphor after another metaphor after another metaphor. It's very rich, but you can't literalize any of it.
Right.
So,
right.
Well, the heavens are the other world. There is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And I think we will learn to read that not just as, you know, the sky and the land. I mean, you could read one level like that, but we're going to read it as in a more profound way that sustaining everything that belongs to the material world is an unseen world. This is why Paul says, and you know, Paul realizes what he's saying will sound odd. I think it sounded less odd in his day than it does in ours, but he said, while we look not at things which are seen, but the things which are unseen. For that which is seen is temporal, subject to change, passing away, subject to mutation. While that which is unseen is eternal, it's enduring. So sometimes when we talk about the spiritual world, we think, oh yeah, that the ephemeral, the less substantial, just you know, the spirity world where everything is ghost-like. No, it's the opposite. Yeah. It is this material world that is subject to change, that is not enduring. And in the book, I unabashedly draw upon some of Plato's thought and the Neoplatonists, Plotinus, and people like that. And when I say, yes, I'm willing to work with, let's say, Hebrew revelation in Scripture, with using the tool of Platonism, some people get terribly alarmed at that, but the synthesis of those two things, there's a name for it, a technical name, it's called Christian theology. I mean, this is what the early church fathers did, and it's why they like to refer to Plato as a proto-Christian or a Christian before Christ, because of his awareness through what he called reason, which is almost more intuitive revelation, that this world must be sustained by a more enduring and eternal realm. He called it the realm of the forms.
Yeah.
And the church father says, yeah, you're right. We call it heaven. You can call it whatever you like, but you're on the right track thinking like that. And that was the dominant way that we all thought about the phenomenon of being until the rise of empiricism in the 17th century, which has its it has its positive side. The positive side is you and I are, I don't even know where you are, Curry. Where are you?
I'm in Texas.
You're in Fort Worth, yeah. All right, and I'm in Missouri, and here we are live doing all of this. That's, you know, technology.
Yeah.
And empiricism opens the door for enormous advancements in technology. That is, as we learn to understand the material world through the five physical senses and the various enhancements, you know, all the microscopes and telescopes and all of these sorts of things, then we begin to understand the material world and we can develop these technologies that we all kind of take for granted, or maybe today are beginning to be a little bit threatening to us. But we did so at a terrible price. And that is, we became so focused on the material realm that we forgot there was another world. Hmm. And then we became, we were possessed with philosophical materialism, the idea that the entire phenomenon of being exists in physical matter, which is nothing more than a superstition. I mean, philosophical materialism can't even account for the existence of matter. You know?
Yeah.
So right. So that's another thing I'm doing. I'm trying to awaken people to a pre-modern way of understanding the cosmos. That, yes, there is this world of matter, but it's transitory. It's passing away. It's not enduring. But there is another world that sustains everything, and that is the world of the heavens.
Yeah, that's helpful. I admit, when I started reading about Platonism, I was like, where are we headed here? You know?
But we're heading with C.S. Lewis. Just you're going to be okay.
We're going to be okay.
Everybody trusts C.S. Lewis.
Well, they trust him because they haven't read him a lot of times. Yeah. So that's...
But I mean, he would just call himself a Christian Platonist.
Yeah. No, and he's a lot more... But he's a lot... What I was meaning is that he's a lot more revolutionary than we have this nice, kind C.S. Lewis, you know?
Everybody wants to own... There's two people that everybody want to own. And that's C.S. Lewis and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And American evangelicals really like to believe that C.S. Lewis and Dietrich Bonhoeffer were essentially just American evangelicals. And they were not.
Yes.
At
Very
all.
Much so. Very much so. I love, though, that even the bringing up the allegory of the cave, right? Where there are people who are in the cave and they can see nothing and they know
that's
nothing.
That's one of the great, whatever we call it, parables, thought experiments. Yeah. In all of history. There's a reason why, you know, 2,500 years later, we're still talking about it.
Yeah. So how does the allegory of the cave what does that speak into heaven to you? How does that transform? Yeah.
Well, the parable of the allegory of the cave, it comes from Plato. And the idea is you have to imagine a group of prisoners locked in a subterranean cavern. And they cannot, they're bound in such a way they can't turn their head one way or the other. Behind them is a fire that's burning, and people are having little cutouts that cast shadows onto the wall in front of them, which is the only thing they can see. And they cannot but think that is reality, that the shadows on the wall are the only thing that's real. But then one day, some prisoner, we're not told how, by grace, escapes his bonds, climbs up out of the cavern into the full daylight, and first it just blinds him. But progressively, over a period of time, his eyes become accustomed so that he can behold what is actually reality. And then, because he's now an apostle or something, he has to go back down into the cave and try to convince the people that they're actually enslaved and that what they take for reality is nothing but shadows on a wall, and that this what they're seeing is not the full story by any means. And of course, that's going to be very difficult for him to do. They're going to think he's crazy and all of that sort of thing. But that's in some ways, Plato's allegory of the cave has more resonance today than it did maybe when it was first created, you know?
Yeah. I don't doubt that. Because we are so fixated with the material, right? We live in material lives, and yeah, even grasping.
This is our shadows on the wall.
Wow, that's a good point. You know,
right?
That is all we oh geez. That hit a little harder than I realized. yeah. And we're obsessed with it. The phone is what you held up for those just listening. We're obsessed with it. My wife was taking our kids to school today, and as she was coming back, a woman like turned into school, like looking at her phone, before drop off with her kid. I'm like, something is very like we are so mystified by the phone, or we are so taken in. I don't know. There's a really cool word that I cannot grasp, but yeah, fascinates us, I guess. So,
well, and there's going to, I don't really talk about it in this book so much, although I have more books in me and they're under contract. So, I mean, it isn't, they're more than just like an idea. One of the next books I'm going to write is called Hope Beyond the Machine, but we're not here to talk about that.
Well, man, we'll have to get back on for that. Jacques Ellul feels like he would be very in that conversation right there. Technology and the technique. Yeah. So is it that we are just fascinated that we are content with the material and
we've also been seduced.
Seduced.
And there is good. A spirit that has captured us. I mean, we are prisoners in stocks with our necks bound and forced to stare at the shadows that we think is reality. But meanwhile, there's a world out there. I mean, there's a world outside of your phone, which is a good first step, just to be in nature. Spend more time doing that. Remember who you are. You're a human being that is a synthesis of the dust of the earth and the breath of God. But don't forget the breath of God part, that actually comes from another world, from the heavens.
Yeah, there's a reality that we are just not seeing. And every day we go about basically pretending like this reality does not exist.
Yeah.
Or living like it does not a lot of times. Is that...
Yeah, and so it has helped fuel the rise of atheism, which there's two kinds of atheism. There's protest atheism, where they have been presented a picture of God that they find morally repugnant, and their own conscience will not allow them to believe that such a God should exist. This is the God that tortures, that creates people to be tortured for eternity, you know. And so... Often when I meet someone like that, I'll say, well, tell me more about this God in whom you do not believe, which is an interesting way of phrasing it, but they can do it. And they'll tell you, they'll describe a certain deity that comes like basically out of like a Chick track, if people know what that is, J.T. Chick, you know, fundamentalist, angry God. And I'll say, well, I don't believe in that God at all. So I believe in God. So I have sympathy toward the protest atheist who their own sense of morality will not allow them to believe in that sort of God. But then there's philosophical atheism, which I want to be gracious here, but I have a hard time not viewing it as a kind of psychosis.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there is a, I just want to say, what do you mean? We're here. Where did this come from? You're going to tell me that matter created mind?
No. Yeah.
And of course, the way they try to argue with it, it's just they just always kicking the can down the road further.
Yeah.
Yeah. But why is there something instead of nothing? Why is there something instead of nothing and you're conscious of it?
Yeah. There's fundamental questions.
I just touch on the book very briefly. I don't dwell on it, although maybe I should have. You know, I try to alert people to the goodness of creation. And it's all around us. And it's a gift. It's all a gift. But the goodness of this, of the phenomenon of being, could be present without you or me here. But we've been invited. We have been summoned up out of the dread abyss of non-being and invited to the party. And if we can think that way, it's like, that should generate some gratitude. Yeah, I understand life's hard. And no one gets out of this without scars and pain. The Son of God didn't, and we won't. But it's not the full story. It's not the end of the story. What we want to keep in mind is what a indescribable gift it is that we have been invited to be. Yeah. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I found so refreshing about the book and probably needed refreshing. Like, we do live in a world of chaos. As much chaos as I remember in my lifetime. And it can be really hard to kind of press on. And at the same time, this whole heaven thing, sorry, not this whole heaven thing, that's flippant language. So heaven can be used in a really a platitude kind of way. Oh, it's fine. Yeah, right. We're going to be in heaven someday, right?
Like, I think I never did that. You really did not.
But yeah. Well, it brings me to a section where you do talk about weeping, and you talk about Jesus weeping at Lazarus' death.
There's a chapter called The Tears of Jesus.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that, because it's not that just we're going to escape and go to heaven. It's that there's sorrow here, and at the same time, there's hope in this goodness, right?
Yeah, so that chapter deals primarily with the story of the raising of Lazarus, which people know this story, right? Lazarus, who's a friend of Jesus, is ill. He's summoned by the sisters. He intentionally delays. He arrives after Lazarus has already been in the tomb 4 days. And both sisters separately say to him, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. And Mary's the second one, and she says that. She says, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. And then she begins to weep. And Jesus says, well, show me where you've laid him. And then it says, and Jesus wept. And of course, we find that tender, and we like the idea that Jesus shares our sorrows with us. But here's the interesting thing about that. How much time was there? Jesus arrives in Bethany, and then, you know, he has these conversations, rather brief, and he's taken to the tomb. They roll back the stone. Lazarus comes forth, and Lazarus comes out. For my own purpose, I say, was it like 30 minutes, half hour? And the reason I do that is because in Revelation, is it 8:1 or 9:1? One or the other. It says there was silence in heaven for about a half an hour. So why doesn't Jesus say, hey, everybody, you don't have to cry. I'm gonna raise him. I'm gonna do it right now.
It's fine. We'll take care of this.
You know, yeah. Just dry your tears.
Yeah.
No need to cry. I'm gonna raise him. No, he doesn't do that. Because I hold two things together. One, I believe all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. I believe that in the end, Christ heals all, and all will be restored. I believe in apokatastasis, the restoration of all things. But we're not there yet. And in the present moment, this half hour, and then when I say half hour, you know, it could be a decade. I don't know how you correspond heaven time with earth time. Okay, so during the half hour of heaven's silence, when Lazarus is still in the grave, we weep and Jesus weeps with us. He doesn't become cow and say, "Oh, don't worry about that. Everything's going to be all right." Everything is going to be all right, but in the meantime, Jesus weeps with us.
Yeah.
See, you see the preacher coming out in.
I love it. I love that'll preach right there. I mean, if this isn't getting you excited, there's nothing that will, I guess, right? I mean, this is the good news. This is the hope. This is what we're
there's some theology in that chapter. Yeah. I got a list here. I still don't have a physical book. I hope they'll get one to me eventually. That's chapter 8. And I really do work a lot with the dual nature of Christ, the full humanity, the full deity. Does Christ know the future? I believe he absolutely does, but that doesn't prevent him from inhabiting time with us and experiencing it as we do.
Yeah.
So there's actually some good theology in that.
Yeah.
And I think if I can say so myself.
I agree. I'd be after you if I disagreed with that. These are foundational doctrines that many of us don't really think about that often, though. You know, back to the Holy, or back to the humanity of Christ. You know, the reason we don't take the Holy Spirit seriously is because we don't take the humanity of Christ seriously.
Exactly.
You know, Jesus walked by faith through the Holy Spirit, was this mediator between Father and Jesus the Son. And so we are we can walk into a similar type of life as Jesus. He lived the most human life possible.
Yeah.
So anyway, little soapbox there, but yeah, I really appreciated that. We, I just got back from Chicago. We were up there for a long time and we lost a friend, much too early. But she had spent a long time, decade plus, sort of in this kind of deterioration from a chronic illness, and just being at her funeral, it'd be really easy to be like, "Hey, you don't have to cry. This isn't sad. You know, heaven awaits us. It's totally fine." And I really appreciated that our community did not do that. You know, right. Like there is,
the Bible doesn't tell us to cheer up those that weep. It says weep for those that weep.
100%. And I think it's such a witness to like the true hope that we have in Christ. So I would love to just hear, I mean, you've talked about being outdoors but what does it look like to live in your mind, or how would you pastor people into living a life that is oriented towards heaven?
I think the most immediate indications of the other world is in fact the natural world. So that's what maybe abuts most directly with that which is to come. I think at some point in the book, I quote from C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, the last book in that series, The Last Battle, where one of the characters, I can't remember which one, says that the reason that we in this world we saw things that were like what we're going to be moving toward, and so we live too much indoors, altogether too much staring at tiny little screens. And I don't want to sound like, you know, I don't want to harp on that and just, you know, be shrill.
It's okay. But I think there's a pendulum swing.
But I think one of the things I talk about in the book, it's the simplest thing. You're going to think this is just silly, but it's not. I'm sitting here and there's a big window over here. You don't see it, but like I said, I'm in my basement, but it's a kind of a walkout basement. And so I have this habit that I try to every night, just go out into my backyard and just pay attention for 10 minutes. You know, I listen, you know, I pay attention. In the summer, you know, I hear the cicadas and the frogs and the barred owl that lives in some of the trees near us, a pair of barred owls. I listen for those things. If it's clear night, I'd look up at the stars. And just try to be very and it was doing that phrase first came to me. It's all a gift. It's a gift, but it's not the end game. We are still in the process of being born. So let's just think about it here. I don't think I use this in the book. I don't. Imagine a baby. You just kind of have to play along with this a little bit with me. Here's a infant in the womb, not yet born. And so their whole world is dark and warm and watery. And they're quite comfortable with it. But now and then, they hear something that seems to come from another world. You know? Could there be another world? They don't have really any evidence of it, but sometimes they sense something. Maybe they feel something. Maybe they hear something. But they know very little about it. Then one day, the worst of all things happens. It's the greatest tragedy. Excuse me. They are expelled from that world. And of course, they are convinced they are dying, that it's all come to an end. The worst thing that could happen is happening. And that's why we all come into this world crying. But it's our birthday. And it comes around every year and everybody comes up to us and goes, happy birthday. So glad you're here. I think the world to come is analogous to that. That we have hints. We have some idea, but actually probably precious little idea. And that in Christ, our death is our birth into another world. Because Christ now fills all things everywhere with himself. For a human being to die is not to encounter death, but to encounter Christ as both judge and savior. I just that kind of thinking, that doesn't mean that we won't approach death with a certain trepidation. And if it seems way too untimely, or even if it's not untimely, those of us that remain, we feel that sorrow, we feel that pain. You know, Jesus, in that whole Lazarus, raising of Lazarus passage there in John 11, he says, he that believes in me, though he dies, he shall live again. They that believe in me will never die. He says two things that appear contradictory. He says, those that believe in him will never die, and those that die, they'll live again. Well, it's the two perspectives. I'm convinced that that what we think is death is birth into another world, okay? But for those that remain, all we see is a departure. They have left the world that we currently inhabit. And so for us, it's as though they had died. But for for the person who experiences it in the first person themselves, there is no death. There's a transition. There is a moving from one world to another. But it's more like birth than death.
Yeah. No, that's such a good word. I've never heard it put that way or thought about it that way. And
I touch on some of that in the book, but I don't use the exact analogy. Probably
should. That's a great analogy. It's a great analogy. When it re-releases, you know, the revision, you could throw that one in there. Towards the end of the book, you talk about one of my favorite mystics of all time, St. Teresa of Avila, and what's known as St. Teresa's bookmark.
She is a 17th century, is that right? Spanish mystic, yes. Carmelite nun. Reformer, had her own mystical experiences for sure. And she said this, it's kind of a prayer. It's not so much of a supplication as a confession about what we believe, a confession of faith. And it goes like this: let nothing disturb you. Let nothing frighten you. All things are passing away. God never changes. Patience obtains all things. Whoever has God lacks nothing. God alone suffices. My wife introduced me to that prayer the last time we walked the Camino de Santiago back in 2023 as our fourth time. She brought that prayer with her, and it became our mantra, because if you're on a 500-mile walking pilgrimage, things go wrong, you know, and you can be disturbed. And so when something would go wrong, one of us would say to the other one, usually it was Perry to me, let nothing disturb you. and the thing that stands out is I see the saintly wisdom. I see the wisdom of a sage in that, and I see how absolutely contrary it is to the spirit of this age.
100%.
I mean, the spirit of the age says, let everything disturb you. You should be terribly afraid.
Yep.
All things are passing away, but it's not heard as good news. It's heard as bad news. And we desperately try to keep everything not from pass. We can't hold on to things loosely and let them go. Let them go.
Yeah.
All things are passing away. But you hear these, you know, these tech billionaires that now want to live forever through technology.
Yep.
I have an idea for a piece of fiction where some of this is actually attained. And so you have these billionaires, whoever, you know, they have found a way to sustain bodily function indefinitely. But all they're doing is they're causing themselves to be stuck at the penultimate stage, and they're not arriving at their full destiny. And then so maybe someone is sent back to try to convince them, you got to let go. You just, you know, turn the machine off, man.
It's like choosing the cave, but for eternity.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So let nothing disturb you, let nothing frighten you. All things are better. God never changes. Patience obtained. Patience is so akin to wisdom that they're almost synonyms. I mean, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. As I examine my own life, the moments I've been the most foolish is almost 100% what I was impatient. And the moments where I have perhaps acted wisely, I say what I was mostly doing was being patient. Patience obtains all things. Whoever lacks God, whoever has God lacks nothing. God alone suffices. I find great wisdom in that, comfort in that. I confess that every day now. It's just part of my morning prayer. There's a point where I just go through those things.
Yeah, I think I might add that to my my repertoire as well. I was very struck by that. I think it is very countercultural, and I think we could use every ounce of being countercultural as we can right now.
That's right. So,
good stuff. Brian, I could talk about this with you all day.
You're a good conversation partner, Curry.
I appreciate that.
In that you just let me ramble on, mostly what I guess I mean by that.
That's my specialty. I love it. It's so good. Are you okay jumping into the final two questions as we kind of wrap up here?
Okay. Sure.
So my first question for you is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Oh, I can tell you that job. It's stranger than you think.
Okay, I love it.
How I was entrusted with this job, Lord knows. There's no explanation for it. I was a junior in high school, so I'm like, what, 17 or something like that? I had a summer job working at the state hospital, a mental hospital, a psychiatric hospital.
Wow.
And my job was basically to babysit 20 insane men.
Wow.
And the things I saw. One day they put me onto across the hall. These were locked wards. These people were not, you know, they were a danger to themselves and others. And so there's a locked ward. And one day they sent me over to the women's locked ward. And just one day. And I hadn't been there 5 minutes. And the first thing that happened was a woman took off all her clothes and threw them out the window. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do here? That I had that job. I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, the 70s were a wild time. Yeah, he's 17 years old. You know, we'll give him keys and, you know, he can babysit him. If something goes wrong, he can call this number. I mean,
that's wild.
I had all kinds of things happen. You know, it was a wild job.
My wife's a social worker, so I know glimpses of that sort of inpatience.
I think they would never let that happen today. But
no way. You'd have to have, all sorts of degrees and, certifications.
I had keys. That's what I had. I could let myself in and out. That's what I had.
I love it. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Don't be annoying. Don't be a religious fanatic. Don't force it. Let it be natural. Don't proselytize. Be salt and light. Be the loving presence of Christ. Believe that everyone that you work with is already on their way to becoming exactly who God intends them to be, and try to look at them through that lens and interact with them in that way. And be patient and be kind. Don't feel like it's your job to save anybody or fix somebody. That's what I would say. Things like that.
That's a good word. I appreciate that. Brian, thanks so much for making time for me and for the work. It's a pleasure connecting.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you, Curry.
Thanks so much for hanging out and listening to A Theology of Hustle. Make sure that you like and subscribe, all the things, and follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram. My hope is that this podcast just encourages you in your work, whatever that may be. So until next time, get out there and hustle.